Welcome. That's my opening words officially. This is the symposium called Will Spiritual Robots Replace Humanity by 2100? I'm Doug Hofstadter. That's a good introduction. I want to thank a number of sponsors. It's important for me to do so because in very brief time I raised roughly $12,000, and all of it came from Stanford, different sources within Stanford, and I'm deeply appreciative of that, plus of a great deal of help from many people. So I'll go through this list. The largest contributor was Stanford's Symbolic Systems Program. These are roughly in order of size. Center for the Study of Language and Information, also known as CSLI. Computer Science Department and Channel 51, Stanford's TV channel. And the Philosophy Department and the Center for Computer-Aided Research in the Humanities. All of those contributed very generously, and I deeply appreciate it. For a lot of legwork and, you know, lots of work, just people taking care of things, the Graduate School of Business Futurist Club. All right, now getting on to more of the content here. Some of you were probably attendant at several symposia that I organized in 1997 in the fall on the question of whether computers were starting to rival human beings in terms of levels of creativity. Those symposia were quite well attended. Some of you might remember that Steve Martin came up and was in the one about humor. It was quite a set of symposia, very fascinating. That was about the past, or you could say the past up until the present. It was what has happened so far. This symposium, by contrast, although it's related, is now looking into the future where it's very murky. The past also is very murky because claims about what things have done and what things even do in the present are still very murky, very hard to figure out. But the future, needless to say, is far murkier. And so this was triggered by two books that came out towards the end of 1998, beginning of 1999. One by Hans Moravec called Robot, Mere Machine to Transcendent Mind, and the other by Ray Kurzweil called The Age of Spiritual Machines. And I invited both of them to come. Things just sort of came together in an interesting manner. It was obvious to me that there were many people who had thought about these kinds of matters. Kevin Kelly, for example, had written a book, quite a wonderful book, called Out of Control, about how biology and technology are coming to merge. Kevin mentioned to me he is associated with Wired, and he mentioned that Bill Joy had an article that was coming out in an upcoming issue of Wired. Little did I know that it was going to be the cover article, let alone the national newsmaker. So that was quite an important thing, and I was very happy to get Bill Joy to come. My old friend John Holland from the University of Michigan, who invented the notion of genetic algorithms, seemed a natural because he had thought about evolution taking place within the medium of computers for longer than anyone had. Frank Drake from the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute has thought about life in other forms for most of his career, and he seemed a natural as well. John Koza, who actually got his PhD studying with John Holland, has studied a rather remarkable type of new way of programming called genetic programming, in which programs themselves evolve by falling apart and putting themselves back together again, a little bit like DNA. And Ralph Merkel is one of the nation's premier nanotechnologists, and all of this is connected with many kinds of new technologies, nanotechnology not the least. And so I try to represent people from all of these different all of these different areas. And that's how I drew together my set of people. I did not deliberately, include among my panel what I would call naysayers. That could be another interesting panel, but it was not the purpose of this panel. That is, people who think that it is impossible for other media, other substrates, to support consciousness or even intelligence. People like John Searle, the philosopher from Berkeley, the Dreyfus brothers, and many, many others. Penrose from England, the Emperor's New Mind, such people. I didn't want to include that kind of a black and white distinction. I feel that this is a question of shades of gray, and I wanted to know what shade are we at, how fast is the shade of gray changing, I didn't want to argue black and white. So that's how my choice was made. I myself have been working in cognitive science and artificial intelligence for over 20 years, making computer models of various aspects of thought. One thing I would like to point out is that I have always enjoyed their failings. I've always enjoyed laughing at how bad my programs were at doing things, even though they were able to do very clever things. It was always clear to me that they were pathetically rigid, despite having achieved some kind of level of flexibility. This, to me, was exciting. The fact that they were failing was exciting, amusing, delightful, and encouraging about the complexity of the human mind. Something started to change in my mind maybe 3-4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, when I first heard about David Cope's computer program called EMI, standing for Experiments in Musical Intelligence, which I won't go into it at all. One of our symposia in 1997 was devoted fully to EMI. But it's about imitating style. I know that Ray Kurzweil, when he was a high school kid, actually studied the imitation of musical style. Dave Cope took this further than anyone could possibly have imagined and has worked on his program for some 20 years. It produces, I will call them for shorthand, new Mozart symphonies, new Bach inventions, new Chopin mazurkas, new Mahler operas, new Gershwin tunes, et cetera, et cetera. You can take that with a grain of salt if you wish, and you should to some extent. But the point is that it has also fooled people at the top-ranked music schools in the country, such as Indiana University, where I come from, the Eastman School of Music. Most of them got fooled by an EMI mazurka, thought it was real, the faculty and in theory. So it's not a joke, and I was very surprised by this and disturbed, because to me music has always been sort of the highest of arts. That was a few years ago. I still was not really all that perturbed, but then came out these two books, which portrayed very fantastic scenarios coming to take place within the next century, roughly, thanks to what Ray has called something like the law of accelerating returns, which is a kind of a generalization of Moore's law. And I'd like to put up a transparency that suggests the meaning of Moore's law. It started out in about 1965 talking about how many transistors you could pack into a square inch. And if you take the logarithm of the number of transistors per square inch versus time, you get a straight line, and I've plotted it here. This is only up till now. Of course, I've plotted two more 50-year periods, extrapolating that straight line. Both Hans and Ray believe that this extrapolation is an underestimate, that in fact it will go up faster than this. So that in itself, this green line might even be an exponential. I personally doubt that, but that's up to my panel to discuss. This is an astounding fact. It is held true now for some 50 years. And in other aspects, other sort of generalized Moore's laws come in, such as not only how many transistors you can pack into a square inch, but how many calculations you can do per second, and so forth and so on. There's also the flip side, how much it costs to manufacture these things. But again, my panel will discuss that. So one has rather amazing predictions as to what might happen. I would point out that Ray generalizes the concept of Moore's law, saying that when one technology gives out, another technology comes in and replaces it just in time, so that even when transistors go the way of all flesh, so to speak. We will have other technologies stepping in to keep the pace going. It's a fascinating hypothesis. Needless to say, it's an empirical hypothesis. It's not something somebody's going to prove rigorously. I'm not going to try to describe their scenarios. That would take too much time, and they will do a very eloquent job of describing those scenarios. I will simply say that I was worried because I cling to the idea of humanity as a kind of a beautiful and sublime thing. And the idea of a very, very rapid transition within a century, where in fact essentially all of us would become things of the past within 100 years, the whole notion of the human condition would sort of recede into history. That struck me as awfully fast. I'm not claiming that these scenarios couldn't come into being. The question is how fast. And 100 years frightened me enormously. I assembled a panel about a year ago at Indiana University on this topic. I didn't feel as if I got a great deal of enlightenment from my panel, although I very much wanted to. I've tried to assemble a new panel to see if I can get more enlightenment. My motivation is quite selfish. I want to know what the time scale is, and so that's why I put my panel together. That it helps you too, that's just a side effect. So Stanford indulged my selfishness with $12,000, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. I want to mention that the New York Times came out at the end of 1999 with a so-called Times Capsule, which was to be opened in the year 3000, okay, by human beings. I really wonder whether there will be human beings, and I'm not talking about the end of humanity from nuclear war or pestilence of the ordinary type. I'm talking about the replacement, as mentioned in the title of the symposium, by something else. I really wonder. One can talk about how fast things are going, and one can always be make a denial. The chess players were making denials. You see the red line. This is the United States Chess Federation rating of the best computer programs in the world. Roughly, I don't know if I've got it exactly right, but you get the point. I saw a graph like this in Scientific American some years ago at about 1995, and it extrapolated a crossing of the green line, which is roughly the level of the human best player in the world. It extrapolated it to around 1998 or so, 2000. And a lot of the chess players said, oh, no, 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 this line is going to bend over, and it's always going to stay below that green line. Well, it didn't. It didn't. And the only reason it hasn't gone above that line is that IBM retired. But it will go above that line soon, and you'll be able to buy, for $5, a program that can beat any human being shortly. So there are a lot of naysayers out there, but I think you have to be worried. Or maybe optimistic, as some people are. There are people who are naysayers, such as John Searle. And here's a kind of a naysaying about the... I just want to point out the idea. One could also be negative about the idea that life could have migrated out of the sea. I mean, after all, it might have seemed fantastic to fish at that time. As it says here, you can't even breathe. Ribbit, ribbit. Well, there are naysayers around. As I said, I always take on John Searle. So here we have John Searle on the left. Sentient life in silicon, don't make me laugh. Wrong causal powers, just syntax, no semantics, blah, blah, blah. The idea is self-contradictory, don't you worry. And on the right, robot, robot. I think that one came out of Hans's laboratory at Carnegie Mellon. All right, life has evolved. To me, it seems far, far more implausible that life would evolve out of sentient matter or animate matter would evolve out of inanimate matter, then that it would change substrate. To me, changing of substrate is very big, but having it happen at all is much bigger. The big part has already taken place. And animals have migrated from the sea to the land. Maybe it can migrate in other ways. Now, I want to bring up two scenarios here that are of concern. One is the one that I originally formulated my symposium concerning, and the other is what Bill Joy's article was about. My symposium was concerned with the scenarios that set out in Hans's and Ray's books, and I have that written there, the sort of the high IQ end of humanity scenarios, that we're left in the dust by our techno progeny. Bill Joy's concern is somewhat different, but it's intimately related, and that's the low IQ end of humanity scenario, that is, we're smothered by self-reproducing technodust. And I'm sure Bill can articulate this far better than I did in five words or whatever, but that is in it, trying to capsulize two different worries. My symposium was largely about this, but I'm sure we will be talking about this as well. All right. Let's see. I want to say one last thing about evolution. Part of the scenarios that are described, particularly in these books, is the scenario of artificial evolution basically making us cognitive scientists irrelevant. That is, we can think as much as we want to about how thought works, but nobody was out there doing cognitive science designing our brains. Our brains got designed by evolution, which is just basically a tooth and claw fight for survival. Why couldn't that happen again within the medium of the silicon or other media, whatever it might be? And the idea is that we wouldn't need us cognitive scientists around to figure out the principles by which minds and brains work. It'll just evolve by itself. That's kind of a scary thought to me as well. And in fact, to me, the whole thing is not exactly a question of whether, it's a question of if. The original title that I made for this symposium was, Who Will Be We in 2093? I also had thought of another title, and it made me more comfortable, which was, Who Will Be We in 2493? So that's really what this is all about. And I will now hand it over to Ray, who will talk for 25 minutes or less, and then we will go on to Bill Joy, and then on to Hans, and then we'll.